International Women's Day is a global day celebrating the social, economic, cultural, and political achievements of women. The day also marks a call to action for accelerating gender parity. Significant activity is witnessed worldwide as groups come together to celebrate women's achievements and rally for women's equality. Marked annually on March 8th, International Women's Day is one of the most important days of the year to call for positive change that advances women globally.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. New York, this is Democracy Now!
We are here to call out the Philippine government to uphold the rights of women workers, to form organizations, to form unions.
Millions are taking to the streets today across the world on International Women's Day, celebrating half the planet's population, even as many continue to face discrimination, violence, and abuse.
The Taliban's intentional and calculated policy is to repudiate the human rights of women and girls and to erase them from public life. It may amount to the international crime of gender persecution, for which the authorities can be held accountable.
We'll look at Afghanistan, what the UN is calling the world's most repressive country for women, and get an update on the women-led protests in Iran. We'll also look at the impact of abortion bans and the criminalization of abortion from the United States to El Salvador, where Teodora Vasquez served a decade in prison after her baby was born dead in a stillbirth at 9 months.
First, they said it was an abortion, and then they changed it from abortion to aggravated homicide. They sentenced me to 30 years.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The occupied West Bank's observing a general strike today, one day after Israeli forces raided a Jenin refugee camp, killing six Palestinians, the deadliest attack by Israel, which has killed at least 73 Palestinians since the start of the year. Meanwhile, in the Palestinian village of Huwara, Israeli settlers ambushed a family, including an elderly man and a toddler. This is the family's grandmother describing the attack.
We were done with shopping and got into the car. He was about to switch the car on. Suddenly, we did not know where they come from. They were like rabid dogs, attacking all at once. We did not see them. The road was empty. It seems like they wait and lay low and hunt people down.
And a correction on Jenin, it was the latest deadly attack, the Israeli forces attacking the Jenin refugee camp. In Ukraine, the mercenary Wagner group says it's captured eastern Bakhmut, the site of protracted deadly fighting. Ukraine has vowed to keep defending the city, saying it's repelled significant attacks and warning its loss would lead to an open road through Ukraine's east for Russian forces. Meanwhile, Kyiv has denied any involvement in September's attack on the Nord Stream pipelines after the New York Times reported unnamed U.S. intelligence officials suggesting a pro-Ukrainian group was responsible, but that there is no evidence the group was directed by Ukrainian officials. Meanwhile, in Russia, student blogger Dmitry Ivanov has been sentenced to over 8 years in prison for being critical of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Ivanov addressed reporters from the courtroom.
You must understand that Russia is not Putin. We didn't vote for him, and he didn't ask us about starting this war with our closest neighbors. I know that tens of millions of people here in Russia are against this criminal war. Lots of, of us have friends and relatives in Ukraine, and we feel their pain.
In the country of Georgia, police use water cannons and tear gas against protesters in the capital, Tbilisi, as thousands of people turned out to condemn a proposed law on so-called foreign agents. The contested bill would require non-governmental organizations and independent media outlets that receive more than 20% of their funding from international sources to declare themselves agents of foreign influence. Critics slam the move as a violation of press freedom and civil society. Georgians also fear it would jeopardize the country's bid for European Union membership. Georgian President Salome Zurabishvili vowed to veto the bill, though the ruling party has enough votes to override that.
No one needed this law. It came from nowhere, but maybe it was dictated from Moscow. It needs to go. It needs to be repealed any way you want.
In Egypt, three journalists from the independent news website Matamasser are on trial, facing up to 2 years in prison and $10,000 fines for allegedly misusing social media and offending members of parliament. Rana Mamdouth, Sarah Saif Aden, and Bisan Kassab are being tried over an article last year about a government watchdog that uncovered gross financial misconduct among politicians. It's the latest attack on Matamasser by the government of Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who Amnesty International is accused of turning journalism into a crime. Reporters Without Borders says 73 women journalists around the world are spending International Women's Day behind bars. Spain's government approved a draft law aimed at bolstering equal representation of women in politics, business and other institutions. The measure, announced by Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez at a rally for the Socialist Party over the weekend, will now be debated and voted on by the Spanish parliament. This is Spain's economy minister, Nadia Calviño.
It establishes a target of 40% female participation in public and private management and decision-making bodies with a realistic timetable. On the political level, electoral candidacies must have an equal composition of men and women by alternate lists. And finally, it is stipulated that the Spanish government must also be governed by the principle of a balanced presence of women and men.
The number of pregnant and breastfeeding women and girls experiencing malnutrition has skyrocketed since 2020 over 12 countries in Africa and Asia. That's according to UNICEF, which says nearly 7 million mothers are suffering from hunger as a food shortage crisis has worsened due to the war in Ukraine, the climate crisis, ongoing conflict, and the pandemic. The hardest hit nations include Afghanistan, Yemen, Ethiopia, Somalia, and Sudan. Children born to malnourished mothers are more likely to develop chronic health issues and have a higher risk of mortality. Back in the United States, five women are suing Texas after they were denied abortions, even as their pregnancies posed serious risks to their health and were non-viable. The Center for Reproductive Rights is bringing the lawsuit on behalf of the women and two doctors. This is plaintiff Amanda Zarosky.
I cannot adequately put into words the trauma and despair that comes with waiting to either lose your own life, your child's life, or both. For days, I was locked in this bizarre and avoidable hell. In a matter of minutes, I went from being physically healthy to developing sepsis, a condition in which bacteria in the blood develops into infection with the ability to kill in under an hour.
It's the first such lawsuit since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade last year, triggering a rash of abortion bans in states across the United States. Gigi Sohn, President Biden's pick for the Federal Communications Commission and a champion of net neutrality and consumer rights, has withdrawn her nomination following an onslaught of attacks by industry lobbyists. On Tuesday, conservative Democrat Joe Manchin confirmed he would not vote to confirm Sohn. Companies like AT&T, Verizon and Comcast killed her nomination over Sohn's support of net neutrality and low-cost broadband. Right-wing outlets also launched launched a homophobic smear campaign against her. She is a lesbian. She said in a statement, quote, "It is a sad day for our country and our democracy when dominant industries with assistance from unlimited dark money get to choose their regulators. And with the help of their friends in the Senate, the powerful cable and media companies have done just that," she said. The FCC, which should have five commissioners, has been at a partisan 2-2 deadlock since December 2020. The Justice Department is sued to block JetBlue's $3.8 billion acquisition of Spirit Airlines. It's the first time in over two decades the U.S. government has intervened to block an airline merger and the latest antitrust action from the Biden administration. This is Vinita Gupta, Associate Attorney General.
Ultra-low-cost carriers like Spirit play a key role in the economy. They make air travel possible so more Americans can take a hard-earned family vacation or celebrate and mourn together with loved ones. We allege that the proposed merger would lead to fewer seats and higher prices for travelers. And we allege that the proposed merger would heighten the risk that remaining airlines would coordinate to raise prices.
And in France, 1.3 million people took to the streets Tuesday in the sixth and largest yet nationwide protest against raising the pension age from 62 to 64. Train services were disrupted, schools shut, fuel deliveries blocked. Police used water cannons and tear gas against some of the crowds. Union leaders say they'll continue disrupting public life until the government acquiesces to the widespread public opposition to its plan. This is a retired worker speaking at a march in Paris.
It is about our children, our grandchildren. I mean, imagine how it will be in 50 years if we reduce the few rights that employees have for the benefit of the corporations that earn intolerable profits without being taxed, of course.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Happy International Women's Day, Nermeen.
Happy International Women's Day to you too and to our audiences. Welcome across the country and around the world.
Well, today, March 8th, marks International Women's Day around the world, celebrating half the planet's population, even as many continue to face discrimination, violence, and abuse. Some women are using the day to speak back to corporate co-optation of the holiday on social media by posting about pay gaps at places that pay men more than women. Women and their allies are also gathering in person for events big and small. Millions are demonstrating in Spain, which on Tuesday passed a new gender equality mandate for large companies, civil service, and government institutions. Meanwhile, in Pakistan, women marched despite threats by conservative groups to stop them by force. And neighboring Afghanistan is now the world's most repressive country for women, according to the United Nations. We'll talk about that later in the show. We'll also talk about the women-led protests in Iran and calls to address the abortion ban crisis in El Salvador and other countries. But we begin here in the United States, which ended the constitutional right to abortion last year. We begin with Nancy Krieger, renowned professor of social epidemiology at Harvard University's School of Public Health, director of the Interdisciplinary Concentration on Women, Gender, and Health. She's also co-founder and chair of the Spirit of 1848 Caucus in the American Public Health Association, which links social justice and public health. She gives the introduction each year to the school's International Women's Day event by laying out its radical history. So, Professor Krieger, welcome to Democracy Now! And Teach. Tell us about this day's roots in social and more.
Thank you very much for having me, and it's wonderful to be with you. And yes, International Women's Day has a very long progressive history that's often not well known. And we have been celebrating it now for over 11 years at the School of Public Health with the Women, Gender, and Health Concentration to bring that history back to life so that people can make the connections. So the very first National Women's Day that took place actually in 1909 in the U.S., it was on its last Sunday in February, and it was organized by American socialists tied to the labor organizing uprising that was going on at that time and also the push for women's suffrage. 1 year later, Clara Zetkin, who made a proposal for an International Women's Day at the second ever International Conference of Socialist Women, which was held in Copenhagen, and they made good on that promise in 1911 when there was the first European International Women's Day that was held in Vienna. It was organized by socialist and communist women at the time, and it was held, importantly, on March 18th. This was to be a commemoration of the 40th anniversary, then, of the Paris Commune, which had started on March 18th in 1871, and radical experiment, among others, in democracy. And it was violently suppressed May 28th. And so they were remembering it 40 years later, just as we in 2023 would remember an event in 1983, which is obviously back to the Reagan presidency in the United States, among other things, not that far ago. And then what happened is that same year it was observed in other countries, including Denmark, Germany, and Switzerland. And by 1917, March 8th became the official day for International Women's Day. And that date, March 8th, corresponded to February 22nd, which in the Gregorian calendar was equal to March 8th, which was the date of a huge demonstration in Russia against the Tsar, led by women, who was about food and wages and rights. And that was a key demonstration that led to the overthrow of the Russian Tsar, and also the provisional government that was came into power right thereafter immediately, among other things, enacted suffrage for women, which was actually 3 years before the United States. So that's when International Women's Day really began to take off, and it became established as a holiday in what was then the Soviet Union in 1922. And it was key, hearing earlier in your broadcast about demonstrations in Spain. In 1936, there was an enormous International Women's Day demonstration led by La Paz Llanara, who was fighting for protecting the Spanish Republic against the fascist government at that time. So basically, until from 1945, after the war, to 66, International Women's Day was pretty much observed only in communist countries and became, in effect, a kind of Mother's Day. It sort of lost the radical edge that it had at the beginning, but it was rediscovered in 1967 by a group of women in Chicago, in the Chicago Circle, which was a women's liberation consciousness group. And they began to call for reviving the history of International Women's Day, and it was eventually picked up in 1975 by the UN and became an internationally recognized day. So here we are in 2011, it was the 100th anniversary of International Women's Day, still a lot of the agenda unmet from what was demanded 100 years prior. And now here we are today in 2023, it's effectively its 112th anniversary.
Thank you so much, Professor Krieger, for that history. And even as many are not aware of its socialist origins, as you've pointed out, could you talk about how it's been linked to other causes for social justice, not just here in the U.S., but also across the world, including, of course, as we were mentioning earlier, reproductive justice and rights?
So International Women's Day has its roots in saying that women and their families, however they are defined, however the women are defined, should have the ability to thrive, to engage productively in the world, to live joyful lives. And that means having children or not, as makes sense, and having the opportunities for those children to thrive. So it's always been tied to demands around reproductive justice, as you just mentioned, around labor rights and about good jobs and about access to education and about safe and sustainable communities and more. So it's inseparable from all the other demands. And that's what was always the original spirit. When you think about who was stepping out, asking and demanding for political enfranchisement to be able to have their lives and their views represented in government and pass laws and legislation and policies that protect people's right to thrive and is crucially important. Right now, very much so through the framework of reproductive justice, which was first articulated before UN conferences back 20-odd years ago, particularly by black feminist organizations and leaders in this country, it was linking, again, not just simply reproductive choice, but reproductive justice, to be able to have the conditions in which people can thrive, and that means for the children that they have, and it also means if they choose not to have children. So these are very connected struggles, and it can't be unlinked from other struggles for health justice, whether about environmental, climate justice, you name it. They come together. They're embodied by people, and they're embodied very much through what we see in the maternal and reproductive health data that you see that are wildly different across different social groups, racialized groups, economic groups in the U.S. and throughout the world, between and within countries.
Professor Krieger, could you talk about what's happened in particular as we mark this day in 2023, what the impact of the pandemic has been on exacerbating inequities with respect to women, not just in terms of health, but also in the workplace as a result of what happened during the pandemic?
Certainly. The COVID pandemic effectively ripped the Band-Aid off, as it were, to reveal wide inequities that were already known by those paying attention to them and, above all, those living and experiencing them. And these inequities were violently shown during the first particularly year of the pandemic, before there was access to any vaccine, and while there was new work going quickly underway to try to figure out how to reduce mortality amongst those who were affected. And so what happened was that the first peoples that were most likely to die, particularly I can speak to the U.S. data, were people that were both the frontline workers, people that were deemed quote-unquote essential, that had to show up at work, but were ultimately treated as expendable, predominantly low-income workers of color, and among those, many in caring occupations, which were disproportionately by people who are considered to be women. And so you saw much higher mortality there, plus also high mortality amongst people that were in congregate homes, elderly homes, nursing homes, which were understaffed, with workers who are overworked, again, predominantly low income of color, and again, predominantly women in those occupations. And then they and people in those nursing homes had high rates. So you saw big inequities in the COVID mortality. And really, back then, it was through excess deaths, understanding them, because there wasn't good COVID testing for everyone. And that's still true now. Not all COVID deaths are actually accurately recorded. And there are differentials by racialized group and economic group in getting good data to understand the impact of the inequities and who was lost. And then, obviously, it's not just about the loss of the individuals who died. It's all the people and their families and networks. To understand, you have to understand the ripple effects that this has put through, understand the impacts, what it means on the kids who have been orphaned, what it means when there are no caregivers for elderly, if their children have died. So the toll continues.
Professor Krieger, you're a renowned professor of social epidemiology. I think the world came to understand how to pronounce the word epidemiologist over these last 3 years. And so if you can talk about reproductive health care. Now, we just had in our headlines today five women suing Texas after they were denied abortions, even as their pregnancy posed serious risk to their health and were not viable. One woman describing how no Texas OBGYN would perform an abortion, which meant she went into sepsis, which meant she may not be able to have another child when that's all she wanted. We're going to also talk about the ban on abortion in El Salvador. If you can talk about reproductive rights, the attack on it, and why this year you're celebrating a birthing center in Roxbury.
Sure. So reproductive justice encompasses reproductive rights and goes beyond that. But reproductive rights are very essential. And that means the capacity to access the appropriate medical care for what one's reproductive needs are. Those can be needs that involve in vitro fertilization. They can be needs that involve not having children and getting access to appropriate contraception. They can be needs that involve actually terminating a pregnancy, including abortion. These are all actual normal health care procedures. They're necessary for people's health, period. And that affects the health of everyone who's around people, because people can be very worried about loved ones when they can't get the health care that they absolutely need. So these fights are there, and they're tied fundamentally to issues around the fights around gender ideology. Gender ideology has been castigated by people that are conservative, right-wing, often from a religious fundamentalist standpoint, that somehow decree that there's no such thing as gender, there's only sex. And then at the same time, they want to have people having babies, but they don't want them to have abortions, but they actually are also not tied to understanding the reproductive autonomy actually is a crucial part of whether one has children or not. So these are the attacks that are underway. It's a global phenomenon. It's playing out particularly in the U.S. and legislatures, particularly those that have had seen a predominance of conservative politicians and voted in. And that's also partly courtesy of all kinds of gerrymandering that's been going on. So you can't be seen as an expression of the quote-unquote people's will, because actually popular public opinion really supports, in many states, all the states, rights for reproductive choice, rights for reproductive justice. And that's also shown in terms of the recent attempts to legislatures to rule out and have popular referenda say, no, actually, we should be still protecting reproductive rights.
Well, as
so what we do at our school, just to say quickly, is we've had this International Women's Day celebration. And this year, what we wanted to do was have this featured speaker, Nashira Birill, who's been key to organizing what's going to be opening as Boston's first neighborhood birthing center, geared to women who have traditionally been excluded and marginalized by healthcare systems. It's going to open in Nubian Square in Roxbury. And we wanted to have something where it both represents the struggle, the radical history of reproductive justice and fighting for it, but also because it's about joy, and it's about bringing people into the world, bringing new little ones into the world in a context that's caring, welcoming, and inclusive. And that's part of the reproductive justice fight, too.
And finally, Professor Krieger, I know every International Women's Day, wherever you are, you sing Bread and Roses. And as we wrap up this segment, we're about to play that for our music break. Can you talk about its radical roots? What is Bread and Roses?
Yes, yeah, so we close our ceremony that we have every year here with that song because it comes actually from very close to Harvard. It was in Lawrence, Massachusetts. It was the big strike that was held by immigrant groups with over 28 different languages being spoken. The international workers of world were involved, the Wobblies. The songbook was there. It gave rise to the song Bread and Roses, which is about what the women were, in fact, fighting for. And that song itself comes from actually a letter that was written to Mother Jones, who was a legendary writer, organizer before she died, which was saying about fighting for bread and roses. It's both. And then the person who was writing, a radical reporter at the time covering the Lawrence March, said that beware the movement that generates its own songs, because songs do carry the spirit of the people. And that's what Bread and Roses was about. And that's why we try to teach it to people every year.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. And, of course, as Emma Goldman says, as if I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution. Nancy Krieger, renowned professor of social epidemiology at Harvard University's School of Public Health, director of the Interdisciplinary Concentration on Women, Gender and Health. Next up, as the UN calls Afghanistan the world's most repressive country for women, we'll go to look at the Afghan women-led marches and resistance, I should say, that's taking place in Afghanistan. But first, Bread and Roses.
For the people hear us singing, Bread and Roses, Bread and Roses, as we come marching, marching, we battle to for men.
Is performed by the Twin Cities Labor Chorus. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. As we continue to mark International Women's Day, we turn to Afghanistan. Earlier this week, a top UN official accused the ruling Taliban of gender apartheid by erasing women from public life. This is Richard Bennett, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Afghanistan.
The Taliban's intentional and calculated policy is to repudiate the human rights of women and girls and to erase them from public life. It may amount to the international crime of gender persecution, for which the authorities can be held accountable. The cumulative effect of the restrictions on women and girls has a devastating long-term impact on the whole population, and it is tantamount to gender apartheid.
Earlier today, another top UN official in Kabul said, quote, Afghanistan under the Taliban remains the most repressive country in the world regarding women's rights.
unquote. Since taking power nearly 19 months ago, the Taliban's move to erase women from public life, banning women and girls from schools, from working with non-governmental organizations, and from traveling without a male relative. On Monday, young Afghan women gathered outside Kabul University to protest the Taliban's ban on female education. Cell phone video shows young women sitting on the ground outside the university reading their books in open defiance of the Taliban. We're joined now by Zahra Nader. She is a freelance Afghan journalist who is formerly a reporter for The New York Times in Kabul. She's now based in Canada. She's the editor-in-chief of Zan Times, a new Afghan women-led outlet documenting human rights issues in Afghanistan. Zahra, thanks so much for joining us again on Democracy Now! Can you talk about the state of women in your country?
Thank you, Amy, for having me on this special day and giving me an opportunity to speak about the situation of women in Afghanistan. As we heard and as you mentioned, Afghanistan is now effectively one of the biggest prisons in the world for women. And what we are seeing and